and this is Sports Grumblings, and I'm here with my good bud, Big John. John, how are you?
I'm doing fine, William. I'm in a good mood. Football's back. The NFL's back, so I'm in a great mood.
Well, I got to be honest, John. Last year, it seemed every week it was just a massive, it was a big game, meaning the high scoring, the action, the suspense, the intensity.
Yeah.
Every single week, I realized that. And my first thought last year was like, oh, my God, this is the season the NFL needed to bring back 70% of conservatives that watch and make up the full watching hour of the NFL. And it worked. The Ravens jacked back up.
Right.
13-second debacle, even though the team I was rooting for lost, it was one of the most exciting games in the past 10, 15 years.
Sure.
And tonight, we got a dud. What are your thoughts? I guess we're going to talk about two or three topics, but let's jump into the NFL Week 1 opener.
True.
What are your thoughts?
There's a lot that was going on. My first thought is, it's a Super Bowl hangover. You know, the Rams had a horrible game at home. Horrible, just absolutely dismal performance. The Bills looked almost unstoppable. The only way the Bills got stopped was when they turned the ball over. You know, the Rams really didn't seem to be able to stop them. I read something that's amazing to me. This is the second of their last three games where they haven't had to have a punt. They didn't punt tonight. And they didn't punt, I think, against the Chiefs or something like that. You know, so it's their offense is going to be a problem. You know, you can see it's just going to be a problem, and their defense looks good. Von Miller, I know you wrote that preseason article about Von Miller being a key addition to the Bills, and it showed. Like, he had a sack. He was balling out for them. He made the other players around him better. So it was an interesting game. It wasn't as competitive, obviously, as I thought it would be, but.
Well, the first half was, actually. I think they went in like 10-7 or something like that, and it was remarkable watching it because I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to blow this game because they're just allowing the Rams to stay in it despite the fact they're dominating. And then, you know, I had to do a little bit of work, and then when I turned the TV back on, I'm like, oh, dear God, you know, what happened here? And what happened was they're just the better team came through. And I don't think it's a Super Bowl hangover. I think it's a fat and happy team is what it boils down to. We've seen this, especially in the 70s and 80s. We saw this a lot outside of the Steelers and the Cowboys. A lot of teams go to the Super Bowl. Next year they just don't do as well because the players get fat and happy. They go on their media tour. In our era, it was the Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore, whatever, you know, Oprah show. Now it's a lot of streaming. But I also – and I'm maybe making light of it, but that's part of it. But from my understanding, because I don't play fantasy football, so I don't follow football as intensely – but I did read, and they did mention tonight how the head coach of the Rams, Sean, I'm drawing a blank here, Sean McVay, held his players out. And I'm one of these coaches where I understand the danger of preseason with your starters, but you've got to get them game reps. I think it's true. I did sports my whole life. I was in the military.
Right.
You have to take that hit. You know, you have to take some hits. You have to get used to the game. So I think all that came into play tonight and hurt the team. However, what I'm not buying are those who are talking about Matthew Stafford's arm. His arm looked fine. You know, I mean, it was just off target, but it didn't look like it was hurting. It didn't look like it was weak. It just and you mentioned it off camera earlier. Maybe you want to expound on it. It seems like there was only one person on the field that Matthew Stafford looked at the whole game, and that is
Cooper Kupp.
And where was the running game? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't understand. A lot of that offensive game plan had me befuddled, to say the least. I mean, Cam Akers, something's up with him, whether it's that he's in the doghouse or he's hurt or something. He didn't see the field at all. He only had three carries for 0 yards. Three carries for 0 yards. I know guys in fantasy football leagues that are throwing their TV through the window right now because they had him figuring he was coming back, you know. Cooper Kupp had a great game.
Yes.
13 catches, 128 yards, a touchdown. That's a great game. He's picking up where he left off last year. But guess what? Nobody else had any catches. Allen Robinson, the guy who was supposed to replace Odell Beckham Jr., No targets. He didn't even get the ball thrown anywhere near him. He was shut out. Their biggest threat after Kupp was Tyler Higbee, the tight end. And I saw him drop at least three passes that hit him in the face, you know, like where it just – he got his hands on it, couldn't hold on to it type of thing. So I'm worried about that offense. And look, the other thing that was very, very clear to me, anyone who thinks Jalen Ramsey is still one of the top two or three corners in the NFL, you might want to rethink your position.
You know, John, that to me, I was saying that when I watched him play throughout the playoffs in the Super mm-hmm. Bowl. And you know, just for the record, this game one just validates how the rest helped them win that Super Bowl. You know, which kind of gets me angry at the Bengals that I'm like, y'all should have won that game. And seeing the Rams now, I'm like, y'all should have really won that game. But you're right. Jalen Ramsey, now in his defense and in every defensive back, I don't care if it's cornerback, safety, or whatnot, the rules, we're never going to see a cornerback with the cover skills that, say, Deion Sanders had, because the rules just kind of hurt the defensive backs.
Okay.
That's a product. But he was battered because Cooper Kupp may have had a great game. But as you were saying, my first thought process was every receiver that went against Ramsey tonight on one-on-one coverage had a great game. You had the data on that.
Yeah,
right?
He was Ramsey was targeted by Josh Allen 7 times. He allowed 6 completions for 2 touchdowns.
Woo.
That's and one of them you might be able to convince me that he was playing zone and passed the receiver through. You know, he thought the safety was going to pick him up, but there was no safety help. I think it was a zero blitz or something like that. So maybe one of them you can convince me there was a communication problem. And the one deflection he had was off a pass that was from the 5-yard line, and it would have. You know, he barely got a finger on it. You know, it was a good play. I'll give him credit. But he looked torched like he did against the Bengals, especially in the Super Bowl. So I don't know if he's been reading his own hype, if he's lost a step, if people have just figured out he's susceptible to certain type of routes. I'm not sure. But if you were to give an assessment of him after the opening night game, yeah, I wouldn't say he's a top 3, top 5 corner in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I kind of feel for the corners, but I agree. You know, I will say this about the Bills. They need to get into game shape. They, towards the end of the game, Cooper Kupp, very, very, very much easily tackable plays, and he's not even breaking tackles. It's, you could tell the Bills were gassed. And the reason I say that, because I had my look when who I think he's an idiot. In my eyes, Chris Collinsworth. Of course, that's what I think of all leftists, and he's just another leftist. When he goes, and there's Leslie Frazier, and I don't know how he does not have a head coaching job after that season last year. Well, when you break the data down, it was actually an inconsistent defense that gave up a lot of points to good offensive teams. The defense was not as good as people assume with the number one overall ranking.
Right.
You combine that with the 13-second debacle, which is where a coach – that's where a coach makes himself look like greatness, or I'm not as good as y'all thought I was. And that's why he didn't get the head coaching job. But what I saw out of that defense, and it's way early, I'm not criticizing, it's just something I noticed. They were a little gassed at the end when Cooper Kupp, you know, Stafford, that's who we kept going to, when he was making a few plays there. And it's hard to say that about Cooper Kupp, because you can say that every game in all of last season. He just kept making players miss. So some of it was Cooper Kupp, but against a team that can keep up with them scoring-wise, like Kansas City, that defense is going to have to step it up. So my point is don't let this big game get to your head, Buffalo players and the fans. Don't count on that Super Bowl yet. But it's funny. People don't realize how big Josh Allen is. After the game, they were interviewing him and Von Miller, and they were literally of equal size.
I think that Josh Allen is bigger than Von Miller, quite
often. But John, Josh Allen is on his way to greatness this season, barring injury. And when he runs, he does not run to slide.
Nope.
He puts that head down. And my fear is there's going to be somebody wanting to make that ESPN highlight, and it's going to take him out. And if they lose Josh Allen, you kiss any Super Bowl goodbye.
I agree.
Am I looking at that wrong?
No, you're right. And, I could think of at least three plays tonight. When he scored his touchdown rushing, which was good because I had him on the player prop to score a rushing TD, he ran over Bobby Wagner, who's an all-pro middle linebacker. You know what I mean? And he took a good hit from Wagner, but he was able to stretch over him. It's a good thing he's tall because he stretched the ball out from the 2 or 3 yard line. But at the end of the game, there's like a minute left maybe, and he took off on a quarterback draw or something, and he ran over another linebacker, but he got hammered. And you could see, like, the coaching staff on the sideline. First of all, it's their fault. Why is he in there?
Why are you running an option like that? Or maybe he audible, do you think?
Oh, I think he just broke the pocket. I don't think it was a designed play. I think he broke the pocket. But you're up by 3 touchdowns. Guess what you do if the pocket breaks down at that point? Throw the ball away. So what if you have to punt? Or if you turn it over, you know, with a minute and a half left or under a minute – why are you taking off from the pocket? And if you do take off from the pocket, why aren't you running out of bounds? Why are you trying to run over a linebacker? I don't understand. And they
Hold on. You do understand. We all understand.
Well,
he is still young and dumb and hasn't even peaked physically.
Right.
You give that to a Brett Favre, Steve Young, a Randall Cunningham, Michael Vick, in terms of after their youth.
Right.
And they're going, boy, you need to slide. And they'll hopefully teach that, you know, I hope he gets it. He's not a dumb kid. And when I say he's not a dumb kid,
right,
his progression from 2 years ago to last year was exponential. Because remember, after his rookie year, what a bust, man. What a wasted pick. Yada, yada, yada. So I really love the Bills. I'm rooting for them. They got the hottest looking woman married to their cornerback, and her name's Rachel Bush. So let's go, Bills. You know? Of course, I mean, facetious, but they seem to have good energy. There seem to be no controversies. So we'll see how it plays out. Any fantasy takes, Big John? Because I know you're playing the fantasy league still.
Yeah. So for me tonight, I only had 2 players going. That was and I play in an IDP league, so I had Bobby Wagner and Aaron Donald. They had pretty good games, you know. But Cooper Kupp, you know, I think we discussed it in one of the fantasy experts leagues. I had the number 1 pick overall. And I took I had the number 2 pick overall, and I took Cooper Kupp. And I remember you were telling me like, I'm not sure if that – I said, yeah, I want to shake things up because I usually never take a receiver in that spot. But people are just assuming he's due for a regression, and tonight showed me
no. You're right.
Unless he gets hurt. Because Matthew Stafford – first of all, Robert Woods is gone. And again, I'm not willing to say that the Rams season's going to go down the drain, right? It may, but you don't do that off one game. Like you said, they don't play enough in the preseason together, and McVay sat everyone. So their first 2 or 3 games in the regular season are going to be their preseason for the starters. So they're going to gel. But it's very obvious. It's very obvious that the first, second, and third person Stafford looks for on the route tree is Cooper Kupp, Cooper Kupp, and Cooper Kupp. That's all there is to it. So he'll get, like, he had 12 catches tonight or 13 catches tonight. So that means he had at least 13 targets, right? He probably had a couple more that just never went to him. I have to look up those numbers. But just, you know, like, I mean, getting 10 targets a game is significant, you know?
Right.
Cooper Kupp is going to average between 12 and 15 targets a game. He's got something like an 85-90% catch rate. He's going to pull in the same numbers he had, unless he gets hurt. Because guess what else we found out today, which I think is not going to change over the course of the season? The Rams can't run the ball.
Yeah.
They can't run the ball for whatever reason, whether they don't trust the running backs, whether the running backs stink, whether the offensive line can only pass block, I don't know. But guess what?
Let me interrupt and ask you this question. Well, first of all, I did agree with Collinsworth in one take about Cooper Kupp. Cooper Kupp has this natural talent, talented gifts from God, But the thing about him is he works extra hard. He works harder than those receivers. Yeah. So when you get that combination, that production is not surprising. But that said, you brought up a very good point. They did not do much, if anything, in terms of working for continuity. So Stafford went to who he knows best, and that's Cup, and they have a relationship. If I'm in a league, I may be targeting Allen Robinson because it may just take some time. It may take 2 to 3 zero, you know, fantasy points or minimal fantasy points before he kind of turns the corner and starts producing. My issue to you, just real quick, on the number two overall pick, it was a bad pick. It was like, dude, didn't you just hear Matthew Stafford's arm? Is there something wrong with it?
Yeah, and what did I tell you? He'll be fine.
Yeah, and he's fine.
Like, you know why? Stafford is one of those guys, if you've watched his career, and granted, not too many people really studied Stafford outside of Detroit, because Detroit's not a media market, and let's face it, the Lions had mostly horrible teams for his tenure there. That guy was tough. He is tough.
He
was tough at Georgia. Now, he had a misfortune of getting hurt a lot, but that was because he was getting beaten to a pulp. And, you know, anyone who's ever watched those old NFL films of him basically with a dislocated shoulder leading like a 2-minute drive to win the game with a dislocated shoulder. One of the greatest scenes was after he threw the he threw a bomb that landed to something like the 1 yard line, and he ran up to the line and he didn't clock it. Like, and we're talking about seconds left.
Yeah.
And instead of clocking it, he took the ball, jumped over the pile, and stretched it over the top. And in doing so, he totally damaged his shoulder.
Yeah.
And he's walking off and he's holding his shoulder, but his teammates are crazy because they won the game and they're all patting him on the shoulder, congratulating him. He's like shooing them away. He's like, don't touch me. My shoulder's dislocated. Don't touch me, you know?
Exactly.
And that guy, when you see a performance like that, I don't care if he only did it once. That's a tough guy. So unless his arm is physically broken, he'll come out and play. So that's why it wasn't a concern for me. As long as I didn't hear, you know, like a torn ACL, rotator cuff, Tommy John elbow, anything like that. If I didn't hear that, I knew he was going to play. There was no doubt in my mind.
He played terribly tonight, but don't give up hope on him. But keep an eye on Allen Robinson, because if he starts to tank it in another week, I target him for a trade. And if you target him, you have to give up a little. So make sure when you trade for him, it's somebody you can afford to lose. Meaning, so for example, I would always be deep at running back. So everybody wanted running back. So strategize in terms of what you're heavy at. But keep an eye out on that situation.
Oh, and absolutely, someone may drop him this week.
Yeah,
someone
exactly.
may look at it this week and say, "Oh my God,
he's always that newbie, player, or the player who just gets so angry and drops him, and before."
And the next thing you know, you've got Allen Robinson stashed on your bench for free. Yeah.
And, you know, hey, I want to give kudos and a little plug here to your Big Questions with Big John and your Bob Zadig interview. I think it was Bob Zadig. Is it Zadig or Zadig?
Zadig, yeah.
He mentioned Johnny Unitas, right?
Yes, he did.
And the 2-minute drill began with Johnny Unitas. I may have heard that decades ago. I don't remember. But I was like, whoa. Like a big Bob throwing the football history. For people out there, the 2-minute drill began with Johnny Unitas. You were in the conversation. Yeah. Just tell the crowd about it real quick in the terms of how that happened.
Right. So Johnny Unitas, if you're one of the 5 people on the planet who likes football and doesn't know who Johnny Unitas was, he was a quarterback for the Colts. But when he got drafted, like back then they used to have something like 30-round drafts, you know, and he got drafted like in the 27th round, 17th, some ridiculously low draft. But he was a hard worker. He may have been drafted by Pittsburgh originally, but after a couple of times he'd been cut, so he ended up with the Colts. And in 1958, the championship game was between the Colts and the Giants, and it was nationally televised. And it is forever known as the game that put football on the map. It's what made football the nation's number one sport. It's what vaulted it past baseball. And it was at Yankee Stadium. It was where the Giants played their home games, and it was a championship game. And the teams were tied. And back then, quarterbacks were truly field generals. They had to call their own plays. They didn't get any signals.
They didn't have headsets,
right? So Johnny U, with like no timeouts, basically took his team, drove them down the field, and called beautiful play calling. Just knew when to throw short, when to go intermediate, when to run. And there's that famous ending where he drove them down to something like the Giants' 3 or 4 yard line, rather than kick a field goal, which would have won the game, and you figured it would have been easier. He called the handoff to Alan the Horse Amici. And Amici, it's this favorite. And Bob Zadek is the one who, when we were talking about the story, reminiscing, he said that he knew the person who took the photograph. It was like some high school kid. And that famous photograph where Amici goes off tackle and lands in the end zone is a famous NFL picture. You know, it's like one of those iconic photos. And it was taken by a high school kid, basically.
I vaguely remember reading about that story. But isn't Amici, didn't he go on to have an acting career and marry somebody famous in the acting world?
To be honest with you, I don't know. He may have. I don't know.
I can't remember. And that was years ago. So these are names. But for the people out there, that's why Tom Brady, when you talk seriousness, he'll never truly be the GOAT. Because no player in modern football who doesn't call their plays, in my eyes, can ever be the GOAT. Because people make fun of Terry Bradshaw. But about how dumb. Terry Bradshaw can't spell cat if he spot him the C and the T. Right. Hollywood Henderson. But Terry Bradshaw caught his own plays. Right. All quarterbacks did. And to me, there's a distinction of greatness from those quarterbacks who won championships versus quarterbacks who don't call their plays. And I'm not taking anything away from Tom Brady because it's not his fault. And in fact, Peyton Manning used to get aggravated because sometimes they didn't want to call in audibles, you know?
Right.
And things of that nature. So kudos to Bob Zadek for a little football education there. And any final comments on the game there, Big John, before we move on?
No, I'm just happy the season started. I'm just happy to see, even if it was a dud of a game, I'm just happy the season started. I've already bought my Red Zone package, so I can just, and my wife already knows, Sundays, just leave me alone. I'm in front of the TV. You take care of the kid. You take care of the cooking, the cleaning, whatever needs to be done around the house. From 1 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. Eastern or 11 p.m. Eastern, I am watching football, son. And the Red Zone is the greatest invention on the planet as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And it was literally driven by fantasy football enthusiasts. Yes, it was. That's the only reason that channel exists. So when anyone gives you grief about being a fantasy football player, remind them of the great stuff that we have driven. Analytics, sports gambling to a large extent was because fantasy football was accepted.
Better sports reporting.
Yep.
Better sports reporting.
More sports reporting. And a lot of the fantasy football ideas worked their way into the NFL coaching ranks. People don't want to admit it, but they did. Like, you know, that whole analytics, when to go for it on fourth down, when not to go for it, who to target, who to draft. So, folks, fantasy, all those nerds that you make fun of that aren't, quote, real football fans.
I'll tell a quick story before we move on. I used to do radio a lot, multiple times per week. And early on, and I'm not tooting my horn, it's everything of what you just said. We're data guys. And the host would always be like, wow, like, how do you know all this? And it reminded me of a scene of The Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox, when I think Hal Jordan, the actor, comes down, the CEO of the company, and goes, how do you know all this? How are you getting this information? He can just pull the thing. I just read the weekly reports. Right. You know, and my point is the data was always there.
Right.
It's like you all chose not to do your job as reporters. You chose to pursue relationships and just get bad info and lousy coverage and lousy stories.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. That's what I'm thinking. Right. You know, I would politely sit there saying, you know, it's out there for everybody to look at. But you can look at it much easier at KFL.com.
And by the way, trivia question. What was the first NFL team in the early 70s to be the first to use analytics? What was they didn't call it analytics, but they used the first team to use a computer and its scouting and its playing.
Yeah, you know, I would probably say the Cowboys.
You're absolutely right. It was the Cowboys. It was the Cowboys.
And you know why I said that? Because I remember as a kid, and I still to this day, or maybe I forgot it. Remember, they would do the flex, the offensive lineman, and they go boom, boom with the head.
Right.
So I'm like, they were trying to get me. And I knew Gil Brandt. He probably doesn't remember me, but I used to see him and talk to him twice a year at the seminars, and he used to talk to us about how much farther ahead the Cowboys became once the Landry era started in terms of how they view players. And they had some tough, great players. So those were great teams.
Well, also, Landry was the first one who didn't allow his quarterbacks to call their own plays.
Yeah.
He was the first one who said, no. And to prove his point, there was a famous game where he swapped out Dandy Don Meredith and, I believe, Earl Morrill on alternate series. He was just like, I'm going to prove that the system is more important than the player. And he kept shuffling these guys in and out just to prove to them that compared to his system, they were worthless.
And Until he got Roger Staubach.
Until he got Roger Staubach, and then he was in there for a while. But I don't think Staubach called his own plays.
No, he
improvised a lot. But, yeah, Roger the Dodger was still – he still had to follow Landry's calls. But anyway.
Don Meredith was more of a gunslinger. Roger Staubach was more of a disciple of Landry, and right. He knew how to run. That's what I mean. Not that he called his own plays. It's that he fit that system very well. So let's move on, or else we can talk football all night.
All night.
So let's briefly talk about, it's not tragic, 96 years old, she led a grand life,
right.
God bless her, and I wish her nothing but the best on her next journey, as I do believe there's an afterlife, what, I don't know, we'll find out one day, and Queen Elizabeth II has passed on, mm-hmm. She was, her son Charles, and I think his wife were next to her as the rest of the family scrambled over, and
right.
She's never affected my life. But she was the only person out of that whole royal lunacy that are nothing but leeches off the Brits' tax dollars. I want to say $2 to $4 billion a year is given to that family, and a bunch of inbreds, a bunch of soap opera drama idiots, a pedophile, sexual assaulter in Prince Andrew. Infidelity with the Queen Elizabeth's own husband, but. Queen Elizabeth II was like a shining, bright light that seemed to overcome all that. She was eloquent. She was graceful. But she, for such a little petite woman, she was a powerful pillar of strength. That's what I got out of it. But I also believe this. They say, and I tend to agree with it, that she saved the monarchy by transforming it into modern times and making it relevant, because they were talking about doing away with the monarchy until she came to power or throughout her early tenure, and she helped modernize it. I think with her gone, with the drama of the idiot prince, the redhead who's married to Markle, what's his name, Harry? Hey, do they have a nickname for them, kind of like Bennifer or something like
No. But no, they're gone. They're out. And I hate doing this because it's going to make me sound like I care about the royals, which I don't.
Oh, we don't. Okay, for the audience, we don't care about the royals. But the truth of the matter is, Queen Elizabeth passing is significant world news.
Well, it is world news. She's considered a world leader, certainly over the UK, the 14 or so Commonwealths like Canada, Australia, and places like that, that technically she's their sovereign as well. Anyway, like the concept of a monarch is so against my nature that I have a tough time admitting to any good coming from a willing monarch. But I will say this, that as far as monarchs go, she seemed to be non-offensive. You know, like, she seemed to have a certain grace and dignity to her. Irregardless is not a word. I should avoid saying it. Regardless of how you feel.
I knew that.
Yeah. Regardless of how you feel. She seemed to be like a decent woman, you know. Certainly lived a long life. Her husband lived a long life. I think he was
99
when he passed away, Prince Charles. So, yeah, it's not tragic. Everyone expected it. It had to happen. I think it's just ironic that dumb son of hers, Prince Charles, he gets to be king. That's the good news. The bad news is, guess what? You're 73 when you became king. You know, I don't know how long you're going to be king for, you know, even if you live as long as your father did, that's just, you know, barely 20 years. But she, I don't know if she saved the monarchy, but it's quite possible because she became queen when she was 25.
Was it that old? I thought it was younger. I did not know. I thought she was a little bit younger.
No, she ascended to the throne at 25 because she just celebrated her 70 years as monarch. So she may have ascended at 25 and been coronated at 26, something like that. But people forget, prior to her becoming queen, England had something like three kings in a 30-year period, you know, because her father took the throne when her uncle abdicated to marry the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson.
Yeah.
And
damn, you know your history.
I honestly don't know how this is in my head, but it is. So England also, so they had seen two or three monarchs in a very short amount of time. So that was troubling. And then the other thing that was troubling was family of Elizabeth's family, that lineage had very close relations and German blood.
Yeah,
so when World War One and World War Two hit, there were some people that are saying, like, can we trust these people? Like, King George had to change his name to George from Wilhelm or something like that because he had too Germanic of a name. And all his advisors told him, when you take the throne to replace your brother, pick a different name. Like, pick something else.
That's right. The kings, which, for the audience, kings and queens at times, when they assumed the throne, they would change their names and continue the lineage, say, like King, like Charles.
Like popes, right? Popes take names of either saints or prior popes, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with kings sometimes. They'll be like, okay, my real name is Wilhelm, but, you know, that during World War II, I don't want to sound like I'm related to the Germans, so I'll call myself King George, you know, so it sounds more British, you know? So when she took the throne, people forget, she was sort of like Princess Diana was, you know,
she
was like this young girl. She was the quote sassy one because she wore long pants instead of just dresses, you know, during World War II. I think I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but they said she was like a car mechanic. She was like a Jeep mechanic.
That was because of the war, World War II.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what makes her so special was, she may have been a queen, but she was in the trenches when that city was being bombed. And what I mean by the trenches, meaning she made it clear that she was one of the people. And she spoke every night. And she had, she did, there were a few things she did, I've forgotten. But it was very impressive. And I think that's kind of what started. But there was, so today I was looking at pictures of her every decade. And the one thing I noticed that never changed was her hairstyle.
Yeah.
She had the same hairstyle. But anyway, God bless the king. What's the saying? The queen is dead.
Long live the king. Yeah.
Yeah.
The queen is dead. Long live the king.
And not to defend Charles, but he's a controversial figure because everybody blames him for Diane and for Diana. You know, and my take is, you know what? It takes two to tango. Yeah.
No, look, that's getting into that sort of soap opera thing. That's getting into the like who cheated on whom.
Yeah, but that's my point though, John. He's not popular. So
whereas
she was beloved, he's not. Now the middle Kate Middleton and who's the other the
next son, William. So
yeah,
Charles's son William, who was the son that he had with Diana. And he's the one who was married to Kate Middleton, you know, who a lot of people are comparing to Princess Diana.
Right.
So William is very well loved, though. That's the funny part. Skip the generation, you know. So all signs, if the monarchy still continues, if the people of England or the UK still feel like they got to have a king and a queen or for whatever nonsense.
That's all they got. I mean, let's be honest. The empire is gone. They're nothing but a shadow of themselves. We've had to carry that country. And I don't care if you don't like hearing that, Brits. We've carried your asses for two world wars. We kicked your asses in 1776 and then in 1812, you know, give or take some years there.
Right.
So you guys are nothing. You're nobody. Your queen is dead. this new prime minister says she's going to revisit the, quote, special relationship we have because she's not impressed with it. Neither am I. I say, cut the cord. Pull our bases out of there. Bring our guys home. And you all defend yourselves. You know, I'm sick of Europe. I'm sick of those elitists. And you know why I loathe the royal family outside of the queen? It's because they're a bunch of freeloaders. And they represent everything our politicians want to become over here. You know, I mean, first it's the Kennedys, now it's the Obamas. It's like, we don't want a king or a queen, leftists or even rhinos. Take your crap and go home. So, God bless the queen, kill the monarchy, and let's get back in the modern era. That's all I have to say on that.
Wow, man, William, you're worked up. Like, halfway through your rant, I think you popped your microphone. It's like, all I heard was, like, crazy static. But, look, okay, William's a little worked up about this. I'm not. I'm just totally neutral towards her. Like, as a human being, I could feel sadness for her family, for losing their mother, grandmother, whatever. So maybe, you know, from that perspective, but in terms of a world leader or in terms of a sovereign or in terms, that means nothing to me.
You know, John, I guess for me, it's the way I grew up as an American citizen watching two dictators. And to me, that's all monarchies I've ever represented.
Yeah, sure.
Is authoritarianism, dictatorships. And then to see these people lavish and slobbered all over, I'm like, wake up, people. You're fools. They're leeches. You know, so I don't get worked up as much as I get angry.
Yeah, they're a wealthy family because they have they're basically land barons, right? They own all that property. So, plus they get certain types of, I think, tax breaks or whatever. So I'm not sure, you know, but basically at heart, they're real estate barons. You know, that's where their wealth is tied up into for the most part. The crown jewels and all that stuff, that's also worth hundreds of millions. I'm not sure who owns that. I don't know if the government owns that and they just get to wear them. I don't know if they own them, if they're passed down from family to family. But it's kind of ridiculous because at this point, you don't even get the joy of watching like a Game of Thrones thing where they're all fighting for the Iron Throne or something. You know, like
there's
going to be someone trying to kill this lineage so they can become king, right? You know.
I mean, that's why I get angry because I'm like, nobody had a chance to take them out, you know.
Right.
If y'all really want to keep the monarchy alive, let's have the battles. Let's have the standing army. Just take them out.
Why not? Raise your army. Yeah, raise your army and figure it out, you know.
It's like, but instead, they were just the last ones before civilization came in.
Yeah.
All right. Again, God bless the queen. May she have a safe journey into the afterlife. And let's get on to what I want to call Big John's libertarian segment. I'm a massive fan of John Stossel. I've always been since the first day I saw him. And he's a libertarian. Yeah. I'm a conservative, but I love him because he cuts to the chase. The one thing about libertarians, of course, to the audience, and John can tell you, I don't like the philosophizer. How do you say that word, John?
Philosophize.
I'm like, do something. But John Stossel is different. He doesn't intellectually educate us. He does it in simple, everyday examples of real life.
Right.
And he does these great little videos. And John, I want you to explain the minimum wage. He has this great video on Twitter. Go to his account, at John Stossel on Twitter. And he has a tweet. After Seattle passed a $15 minimum wage, a Seattle business owner told us she stopped hiring beginners.
Yeah.
The politicians have no sense whatsoever, she says.
Yeah.
Do you want to educate the audience on what John Stossel means by that?
Yeah, sure. And it's part of a big package. So what people don't realize is minimum wage laws, forget the number. It doesn't matter what the number is. It could be $10 an hour, $15, $100. It doesn't matter. The point is that the real minimum wage should be zero, right? Wages should be something that is determined between employer and employee. That's it. There should be no government involvement. People forget the minimum wage started out in the U.S. as a racist, exclusionary law that was meant to strengthen unions, which were exclusionary bodies, and it was meant to stem the tide of cheap labor migrating from the South to the North.
From specifically Black Americans getting hired over White Americans. Just to be clear. And the unions were leftists, represented by leftists, by Democrats, you know?
Yeah,
and,
well, I don't assign political parties because they have well, they don't have like in the turn of the 19th century, 20th century, there was no, like, those Republicans and those Democrats bear no resemblance to today's Democrats and Republicans, right?
So saying
they're Democrats is meaningless.
Oh, yeah.
Were they socialist progressives? That's a different story.
No, my point is this. They were, it's the Democrat Party who's always been trying to stifle the American Black individual, male or female. To me, because I've studied the unions for the past, the posters, and my God, John, I'm sure you've seen some of those posters from that era. Oh, my God.
Well, yeah, they were very, look, people think unions benefit society somehow. They don't. They benefit their members. That's fine as long as they, you know, as long as you understand that. And as long as the law doesn't protect unions, that's my beef, you know?
Right.
But anyway.
Yeah, I'm digressing. I apologize.
So what unions used to do would be like the following. They'd say, you know, Congress, there's a lot of poor people out there that are getting screwed over by the captains of industry, by the Rockefellers and the Carnegie Mellons. You ought to pass a law that everyone, the minimum wage is 50 cents an hour back then, you know? And Congress goes, yeah, we should do that for the people. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll protect the people. Well, what happens in that case? First of all, when it takes away unskilled labor, which disproportionately back then was minorities, Black Americans, immigrants who didn't speak English,
Italians, Irish,
Germans, Greeks, Poles, everybody, anybody who didn't speak English, basically – It because those people would offer their services for less money because they were starving, right? So they'd say, oh, how much does that American over there want to offer it? Oh, they want to do it for $1 an hour? I'll do it for 75 cents an hour.
Right.
And more often than not, they were just as good as their counterparts. So they passed these laws under the pretense of helping the workers. What happened in those cases? You had two things. Minorities were not skilled enough that their labor justified the minimum wage. So people would say, well, if I'm going to have to pay $1 an hour, I might as well get the white worker with 20 years experience or 10 years experience. Why would I hire the Black worker or the Italian worker or the Polish worker for the minimum wage when they have zero experience or next to zero experience, right? So you had that going on. Simultaneously, you had the unions coming in who then would even screw over the minimum wage by saying, why would you pay minimum wage? Listen, if you're paying a premium anyway, use our members. Yeah, instead of $1, which is the minimum wage, they charge $1.50 an hour. But guess what? They do the job of two people, and we'll have them here. We'll make sure everything's done right. By the way, your windows won't mysteriously end up broken and crap like that. So it was the beginning of basically organized crime.
Exactly.
So what happened is, it actually increased unemployment. And even more conspicuous, or I should say more under the covers, was the fact that it targeted minorities. So the people that it was supposed to help the most ended up being hurt the most by minimum wage. And that's something that continues to this day. The other thing is that
Seattle specifically.
Yeah, Seattle specifically, but anywhere, honestly. Ask yourself this. If the minimum wage worked, why is the minimum wage $15 an hour? If you listen to Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC, even that idiot Robert Reich, who, you know, did a press conference for us.
Little man, right?
Yeah. Why not set the minimum wage at $100 an hour? Then we could all be rich, right? We could all be rich. Why wouldn't that work? Well, they go, obviously it wouldn't work because people couldn't afford it. Exactly. Who are you to decide who can afford what from a central authority? That's not the way free markets work. So basically, you've got to get rid of the minimum wage entirely. Here's a personal example. My son, I mentioned before, is autistic. He cannot justify a minimum wage. He does not have the skill set to perform a job for $15 an hour. He does not. And I, quite honestly, would be happy to pay an employer to train him.
Right.
So after I die, he'll be able to do a job by himself. New York State will not allow that to happen. If they ever catch wind that my son is working somewhere and his pay at the end of his shift is a soda or a slice of pizza, because that he doesn't know anything about money, right? He'll work. He's happy to learn to work. And then, hey, guess what? You did a good job. Here's some pizza. Here's some soda. Here's like an ice cream cone, whatever he enjoys.
Right.
New York State.
Experience, right?
Right. Get job training. New York State will jail and fine the business that hires my son under those conditions.
You know, John, I have my own story. When KFFL was going and I was building out hot off the wire, putting in shifts, and I worked with the college kids. They submit their schedules. I'd fill them, you know, I'd give them, here's your slot. It was really pro
right.
employee. But the minimum wage was going up to $15. This was maybe 10, 15 years ago. And so instead of expanding, I just stopped hiring.
Right.
I was like, well, I try to tell people, well, I had to stop hiring. It was no longer in my budget. Well, that's not right, baby. I go, that's what somebody was telling me. Well, maybe you should do the right thing. I mean, I'm like, what? You think trees grow? You think I got bark money? You know, it's people have no income. They think we can pull money out of anywhere.
Well, business,
business.
Yeah, people who don't run businesses don't understand that. And by the way, that's also where you get this misdirection sometimes, because sometimes they'll raise the minimum wage in the city and they'll say, see, the unemployment didn't go down. But what they fail to notice is the opportunity loss, meaning
right.
if I have two employees at $7 an hour, or use the even numbers, $10 an hour,
right?
And they're doing two jobs for $10 an hour. Once the minimum wage goes up to $15 an hour, if the work increases, I'm not going to hire a third person. I'll pay them the $15, which is now the law. But guess what? The two of you now have to do the job of three people.
And I justify it because you've just gotten a raise.
Exactly.
And here's the other effect. When those people get raises, the people above them who are earning $15, they go, whoa, whoa, hey, boss, we need to talk now. You know, I'm better qualified, and I'm more loyal. I've been here longer, yada, yada, yada. He's making the same amount as I am. So you're kind of screwed. You know, if people don't want to realize these are basic tenets of surviving in the small business world. And what's worse is corporations like Amazon and Walmart and Target, they love it because it drives the smaller businesses out of business and you're forced to go into those corporate shops, which is fine, but it's not a fair system. And life is not fair, I get it, but we don't need politicians making it even worse than it already is. You know, any last comments on that, Big John?
Well, I think the overwhelming majority of people, not politicians, not lawmakers, people, they intuitively think that the minimum wage is a good thing. Why? You're putting more money into people's pockets. Like, oh, wow, people are poor.
Right.
What people don't understand is you can't look at anything in the economy in isolation. It's very rare that you get events that are very so isolated that you can say this is where they began, this is where they ended, and this is the exact effect they had. It's very rare. That's why someone like Friedrich Hayek used to say, you know, it's the pretense of knowledge that a lot of economists have. They think they know what happens. Like he would say that about Lord Keynes, right? He would say he has the pretense of knowledge.
Yeah.
And economics, the duty of economics is to show men how little knowledge they have. So the minimum wage almost sounds like, hey, you know, raise it, you know. No, it always has devastating effects, either directly through unemployment, meaning like in Seattle's case, unemployment skyrocketed among the restaurant industry, which was one of the predominant industries hit or affected by this minimum wage directly, right? Unemployment went up. To your point, that video shows people who were saying, we're not hiring anybody.
Yeah, and to expand to the audience, what's happening in Seattle, a lot of young kids are not being hired. They're hiring people who are probably a little older, have been working in the industry a little bit longer, and people who they can trust. Because y'all may not want to admit it, world, but a lot of youth do not respect that entry-level job where they're supposed to learn accountability, responsibility, how life really works. So an owner's going to go, I'm not going to deal with that headache.
No, why would you?
I'm going to hire the retired guy who just needs a part-time job and is happy either greeting people or doing whatever I ask him to do. And so who loses out? Our youth and our country. Because this is just another way we fall behind other countries in terms of growing the intelligence and the intellectualness
well,
of
our youth. You're right. You're absolutely right. Think about our youth, who, by the way, Milton Friedman always used to say, the people most affected are minorities, but specifically teenage minorities.
That's right.
Because the kid who used to be able to sweep up a movie theater or used to be able to do deliveries or flip burgers, right? Once that minimum wage hits, what's McDonald's going to do? It's cheaper for me to build robots.
And that's coming. It's already happening.
It's already happening.
Large areas.
So, you know, good work, Bernie Sanders. Good work, Elizabeth Warren. Because pretty soon, all these people that you're encouraging to go out and strike and fight for 15 and all that other nonsense, first of all, learn some economic theory. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, where are you going to be when all these people are unemployed and replaced by robots and replaced by automation?
They're going to be living in their gated communities, looking
yeah,
down
they don't
as,
care.
As their servants go to the door to pick up their Uber Eats.
And honestly, William, that's one of the things that people like John Stossel and myself, just being libertarians, that's one of the things we loathe. That the perception is, if you talk to people, hey, what about libertarians? They're just selfish a-holes who only look out for themselves. They're rich. They don't care about the poor. They don't care about the downtrodden. No. What happens is libertarians go beyond the Band-Aid. We go beyond the, like, just give them $15 an hour. Like, I tell people, like, seriously, if that was the main issue, why do you only ask for $15 an hour? Why don't you make the law $100 an hour? Make it $500 an hour. Then we could all be millionaires, right?
And you're right, John. And I'm laughing because I don't know if you noticed, but I've been hammering the Libertarian Party on some of their posts because I'm like, stop. You're pontificating. How about working on persuading? And everything you just said goes to my point. Libertarians need to learn how to persuade and get those points
across.
And I say the same thing about conservatives and Republicans. That's the problem of both the Republican Party and the Libertarian Party. There may be massive differences, but there's a lot that we align with too. But the same problem is there. We don't know, or not we. They don't know how to message. They haven't booted me out officially in the Republican Party. But I went from the rising star to,
right.
Man, we don't like you. You just don't want to get on board with what we want to do. You mean
right.
Screw people over? No, I don't.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, but anyway, yeah, so that's like a little pet peeve of mine. You know, it's like.
I agree.
Anyone who says, like, oh, you're cold-hearted. Well, yeah, look at my family. Tell me if I'm cold-hearted. Look at how much I consume versus you guys. You know, how
but
much
not only
do
that,
I take?
Look at how many people you've helped.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, you know, just because I don't go around – listen, there's good-hearted conservatives. There's good-hearted liberals. Like, one of my best friends in the world is – I call him a hippie. He's like one of these old-school liberals, you know, from the 60s. You know, peace and love, you know, mamas and papas and dancing around the earth and shit like that. But quite honestly, he lives his gimmick. Like, anytime he sees a homeless guy in the street, he'll stop, he'll open his wallet, whatever's in there, he goes, here, go get yourself a meal. You know, like, I don't agree that's the best way to handle the situation, because I think in the long run, you're not helping them.
Right.
But at the same time, I can't accuse him of being dishonest. I can't accuse him of hypocrisy. He's living his gimmick, as they say in wrestling. He's become that liberal character. So,
you know, John, I agree. But the pushback I will give is, it's not, as you said earlier in the show, it's a completely different, very progressive, socialist, authoritarian party.
Yeah.
And people are being converted more and more. So your hippie friend is what I call an outlier now.
Whereas he's old school.
30 years ago,
without
that would have been the norm. Because
yeah, without a doubt.
Part of the probably the blue collar, the blue dog type Democrat. It's like, yeah. You know, Huff Arkush, my old boss, the guy who got hammered in the media.
At Pro Football Weekly, right? Pro
exactly,
Football
because, Weekly, yeah. You know, he told the truth and he was wrong. You know, he was taking his personal beliefs to make a professional judgment on who the best football player was. But that's Hub Arcus. That's why I love him to death. He's that kind 60s hippie that just wants the world to get along and doesn't have a mean bone towards anybody. But he's part of the progressives now. He unfollowed me. You know, and to have proper dialogue, when you unfollow somebody, that tells me a lot. You know, and I think that's a good spot to close it out there, Big John. I kind of like this libertarian segment because, again, John and I will always debate certain issues based off our John's way, how he grew up and how I grew up. But to me, libertarianism at its core is incredibly important because I don't care if you're a Democrat, a Republican, a leftist, a fundamentalist. At our core, we start out as libertarians, and then ideology creeps in. But the reason I say that is that we peel back the layers and work together. Libertarianism is the one aspect that will transcend every political party, in my opinion.
It might be. I don't know that you're right, to be honest with you.
I'm right, damn it.
But I hope you're right. I really want you to be right.
I think I am, John, because if you peel back the layers, I think that's how there are Democrats with libertarian aspects.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I just think there are some people, and unfortunately I've run into a lot of them. I think there are some people in this world that just want to be in the business of telling other people how to live their lives. At the end of the day, I'm not talking politically. Exactly. I'm just saying their personality is like, I know what's best. And trust me, you'll be better off if you do what I tell you. Like, that nonsense should stop once you become an adult. Like, the only, only parents should be able to tell their children, not other people's children, what's good and what's bad. They should try to teach them. Like, I'm a grown man. What makes you or anybody think they know what's best for me? I mean, talk to me if you want. Let's have a conversation. But to use law, to use force, to use guns, to use police, to get me to do, quote, the right thing for myself? Screw you. I know what's best for myself, not you.
And for the world, John is so mellow. That is angry, emotional John.
I just got very angry. I don't know if you could tell.
John, it's a great show we had, and it always happens. We're in 30 minutes, but we just have fun talking about this. But I kind of think we should probably start incorporating a little libertarian segment in our points on the board, because that's part of the reason we're doing this. We're conservative libertarians in a leftist sports industry. So good stuff, John. And to the world, we shall see you next time. This is Points on the Board. You can find us on Spotify, on Apple, on podcasts?
Anywhere we could go. Apple, Google, Spotify. Find us on YouTube, on Rumble. And listen, if you forget all that nonsense, just go to sportsgrumblings.com. Exactly. You'll find us there at all points. And don't forget, William's Fired Up podcast, which is the conservative side of things, where he doesn't have Big John to calm him down. So you watch Fired Up. If you want to watch a fiery Latino rant about conservative politics, you watch William's podcast. And then you could catch my interview show, The Big Question of Big John. William mentioned Bob Zadek, who's a libertarian in California, is a radio host. Good guy. Turns out he's a former New Yorker. I had a great time interviewing him. Catch that if you want. And we've also got some big guests coming up. So listen, sportsgrumblings.com, we're getting the podcast together. We're building out our content network, articles, podcasts, audio, video. We've got it all, William. We want to build out this network. Please help us out. Subscribe. It's free. Go to our YouTube channel. Go to our Rumble channel. Subscribe. And hope to see you again next week, everyone.
Until next time, America and the world. And God save the Queen. Good night.